ATTR-CM, or as it's formally known, transthyretin amyloid cardiomyopathy, is an underdiagnosed but potentially fatal disease that affects the heart muscles. It's difficult to identify all the people living with ATTR-CM, but it's been estimated that it affects at least 400,000 people worldwide. It's a type of amyloidosis, which is where a protein that's normally found in the blood, called transthyretin or TTR, starts to become unstable, clumps together and deposits in various organs of our body. When these protein deposits build up in the heart, it leads to diseased heart muscles or cardiomyopathy, hence the name ATTR-CM. It's a complex disease and can be genetic or can be related to other factors such as age. It causes the heart muscles to become thick and stiff, leaving the heart unable to pump sufficient blood or pump properly. If left untreated, it can lead to heart failure. On top of that, symptoms differ between people and are often very subtle, leading to challenges in getting diagnoses, including a lot of misdiagnoses. In fact, most patients report a delay of about 6 years before getting a diagnosis, and there remain significant gaps in the diagnostic process and timely medical care for patients. I'm Shreya Srikhande, and I'm delighted to be joined today by David Gregory from the Amyloidosis Alliance and Mike Lane from the Amyloidosis Army, who are both ATTR-CM patients. Welcome, David and Mike, to this World Heart Podcast on ATTR-CM, the patient story. So we've heard that ATTR-CM is a complex condition, and we know that not all patients experience the same symptoms. So I'd like to start with you, Mike. Can you share your experiences in terms of the symptoms that you had?
The first symptoms that I have now, and this is in retrospect because I had no idea what amyloidosis was until I got diagnosed, but the first symptoms I had were like neurological symptoms. You know, I was having a little numbing, tingling, stuff like that. You know, my general practitioners sent me to a neurologist and, you know, maybe there's a nerve pinch there. And then I went on, my bicep ruptured. So my doctor sent me to an orthopedic doctor. He looked, he said, okay, well, you know, there's two muscles in your arm. I never seen both of them break. You know, you'll be all right. And, you know, it just continually, these little symptoms, and as you get older, they're like common to a lot of things that other, you know, that older people just get by age. And, you know, in here in America, the medical profession is like all silos. They're all specialists. You know, you go see this guy, this guy, this guy. But unfortunately, they don't really speak, you know, among each other and put all, you know, the symptoms together. And amyloidosis is such an unknown, even among the doctors. You know, very few doctors know for it. They don't know it. They're not looking for it. So it wasn't until like several years went by and several doctors went by that I was getting heart complications. You know, I was getting out of breath, AFib, you know, and I mean, it was really getting bad. And so I finally went to a heart doctor. The first heart doctor I went to, he really didn't know anything about AFib either. I mean, about amyloidosis. He was treating me for AFib. You know what I mean? So my condition then was really bad. I mean, I couldn't walk 100 feet without resting. And so the AFib was, you know, it basically turned into persistent AFib. So he sent me to go get a cardioversion. So when I was in the hospital, you know, I was strapped up, ready for the cardioversion. The nurse came in and looked at the screen. She says, you know, that screen's not really like an AFib to me, you know. She says, I'm going to go talk to the doctor. She came back. They put some more wires on me, turned it up. You know, she said, you know, I still don't like this. She went and got the doctor who was a different doctor doing the cardioversion. It's not my doctor. And he came in, he looked, you know, he did some ultrasound work. And I mean, he literally picked his phone up out of his pocket and called my doctor and said, he's not going to do it. You know, so fortunately this doctor, you know, he knew about things, you know, so he went, he gave me a whole gamut of tests, you know, PYP, MRI, echo, all, you know, all the standard stuff, right? And then, you know, I went back to his office a couple of weeks later and he says, okay, I got good news and bad news. He says, you know, the bad news is that I think you may have this hereditary, rare hereditary disease. He says, the good news is our hospital just hired an expert in amyloidosis. You know, it's starting next week. You know, so you know, there I went. That's how I finally got diagnosed. I mean, I went to the other doctor that just they came, Dr. Spurry, who specializes in amyloidosis, and you know, he went through everything, came into the office, he told me, he says, well, you know, you got amyloidosis. I don't know what that is. I never heard of it, right? But at that time, this was 2018, there was no treatments, you know. So he's saying, you know, this is, you know, this is a rare disease, there's no cure for it, we really don't have any treatments. You know, so he says, I asked him, I said, well, you know, what's the prognosis here for me? So he said, you probably got like 2 or 3 years to go, you know. So that's not real good news. And he gave it to me on my birthday. I mean, that's not a good birthday present, you know what I mean? So, you know, fortunately, there was a drug out that wasn't approved in America, but it was approved in Europe already, tafamidis. And through my own, I guess, self-advocacy, you might say, I was able to weasel my way into Pfizer and found a doctor in the tafamidis department who I mean, he must have just felt sorry for me, or you know, he was a doctor. Now he's like a big corporate person, but you know, he was a doctor at the start. He's a medical doctor, so you know, he still has that in it to help people. And he, you know, he says, look, if you know, let me get a hold with you and your doctor. I might be able to. So I was able to get tafamidis on compassionate use before it was approved, which made a tremendous difference. I mean, it literally saved my life, you know. So then, you know, things started getting better. Then, you know, here in America, we got some other we got some other treatments. You know, we have like tafamidis is a stabilizer. They have the other treatments out now they call silencers. They actually shut off the production in your liver. So I mean, I'm on dual therapy. I mean, I just came from a big conference in Chicago this weekend where the best doctors in the world were arguing back and forth about it. You know what I mean? But whether you need them both, whether you don't, but there's no evidence, you know, there's no evidence now to prove either one right or wrong. But I know I'm taking both and I'm doing well, so I'm not changing. You know what I mean? So, I mean, and that's, you know, and that's, you know, that's a several journey, year journey for me. And that's typical. Even here in the United States, you know, it's typical that it takes this long and you see that many doctors before you finally get the final diagnosis. And unfortunately, most of that time it's only after you have, you know, organ damage like in your heart when people start really taking intense looks at why this is happening, you know. And you know, with the treatments we have now, you know, early diagnosis is key. You know, I mean, it can literally save people's lives and give them much better and much longer lives.
What a story, right from, you know, the whole host of people that you had to consult and specialties that you had to consult, to getting a diagnosis on your birthday, to managing to get into this program for treatment. That's incredible. And I just wanted to ask, so you started with neurological symptoms and then it kind of progressed to the cardiac symptoms before you got the diagnosis. So from the time you entered the system for your neurological symptoms, how long did it take till 2018 when you got your cardiac diagnosis?
It was probably almost 10 years.
Wow.
It was only 10 years. You see, because the neurological symptoms, you know, they're like typical symptoms of people. I was in my early 50s then, you know, and you know, you start to get older, you know, things don't work as well as they could. But you know, the combination, like neurological symptoms, the ruptured bicep, bilateral carpal tunnel, right? These are key indicators. So if you have a couple of these symptoms, you know, your doctor should automatically rule out amyloidosis. You know, it may not be amyloidosis, but that he should rule that out and then go on from there. But unfortunately, there's so many doctors that doesn't really know about amyloidosis. They're not looking for it. You know, I mean, I was at a symposium of all doctors like a couple of weeks ago in South Carolina. There was a cardiologist there told me that they've been in practice 5 years. They've never diagnosed a person with amyloidosis. You know, in the primary, you know, in a large part of her practice are African Americans who's, you know, they're 1 in 25 test positive, you know, and in the programs we do, where we have one program in Detroit now where we've started testing people at our public, you know, community awareness meetings, and we're showing a consistent 10% in the black population that comes to our meetings. So For this doctor to say she never diagnosed anybody, that doesn't mean she hasn't seen them. She's seen a bunch of them. She just hasn't diagnosed them. And that's the problem, we face here. We're in America, we think we have such a great healthcare system, and all these resources and everything. We still have that problem here, and it's really, I mean, this is stuff that we work every day, like every day we're working on getting the word out and awareness. Like our organization, Amyloidosis Army, we work primarily in the underserved community. We go to the community and say, hey, look, if you have these symptoms, this is what you need to be looking for. And we give them resources, we give them stuff for their doctors. We'll stick with them until they get it right, either diagnosed or cleared, you know what I mean?
Oh, that's amazing. David, I'd like to now come to you to hear about your experiences with the healthcare system and getting your diagnosis on time. So, how long did it take? What were the kind of tests that you did?
Yeah, so a little, well, everyone's story on this amyloidosis journey is different, but in my situation, the first instance, I was having some heart issues in terms that I was a very keen hill walker, very small mountains, but I used to go up them regularly, and I started having trouble. I thought, well, perhaps like Mike said, you hit 50, things get a little bit slower, etc. But I kind of started having a bit of breathlessness and mild chest pain going up, and having to stop regularly. So I thought I need to go to the doctor. Went to a GP. They obviously couldn't say too much, and I was referred to a cardiologist, local cardiologist, who did all the proper tests, because you're looking for things that are heart related. So on ECGs, put you on the bike test, nothing really identified, very thorough, did everything. And then he said, well, let's do an angiogram. Thought, oh, that's gonna be the ultimate test. And he'd done all the cameras inside the heart, took them out, said, look, for 55, looks normal, can't see anything wrong with it. Of course, in amyloidosis, it's not the inside plumbing that's the problem, it's the muscle where it starts to cause issue for us. So ultimately, at that point, that took about 10 months of nothing being diagnosed. So at the same time, my sister, who's about 10 years older than me, she's been going through the hospital system now probably for about 5 years. She's gone to cardiologists, she's gone to peripheral neuropathy. She had problems with water retention, weight loss, leg and hand pain. She had it all. And sadly, probably the rest of my siblings thought she's almost a hypochondriac, us not knowing that actually, as Mike says, they're all in their own silos. They're all looking for the things that they normally look for, and nobody at that point was putting those things together. As it happens, one cardiologist, another one she was referred to, he actually put the symptoms together, the red flags, and he actually said, I think this is amyloidosis. And he only knew about it because he went to college, one of the specialist doctors in London. So he wasn't like he probably had 5 minutes training on amyloidosis over the 7 years of activity. So to be fair to him, he did understand it, and he sent my sister there, and they did all the tests. So fortunately, because I was overlapping, well, not fortunately, that's probably the wrong word, but in terms of my sister having all the challenges of it, they then said, look, you need to go and diagnose. She did get confirmed as having it, and she was way down the list. She was, way down her life through not having any treatments during that time. So I went to, we have a specialist hospital in London where most people go, even though currently there's a couple of new ones open in other cities, but this was the one place she went. And they confirmed, they did all the tests with me, walking tests, MRI scans, SAP scanners, ECGs, all of it. And by the end of the day, they confirmed that I was very fortunate that I, well, not, not fortunate getting having the disease, but very fortunate that I'm just starting with it. So I'm a very early receiver of this. I'm one of four siblings. Three out of four have got it. My sister's passed away now a few years ago with no treatments. There was nothing there in 2018, 2019. And so that was, that's obviously, she didn't have that benefit that my brother and I are actually able to have the treatment that's available now. And we're on one of the gene silencers. There was one challenge with it. You couldn't have the gene silencer if you had the heart issue. You could only have it if you had peripheral neuropathy. So to be fair to the Central London Specialist Centre, they said, well, we're going to send you to the neuropathy at Queen's in London, and we're going to see if we can find anything. And it was confirmed because, again, carpal tunnel, that was one of the early signs. So they were able to take some samples of that because I just happened to have that at the same time. They also did some sweat tests, and they said your sweat glands aren't right in certain parts of your body. They were really looking for very early stages of it. I had some issues with your urology as well. And they said, yeah, you have got very early peripheral neuropathy. And again, with the hands and feet, very mild. And that was the enabler of me and being able to get this the drug, because 2018, there was nothing. They gave you an off-label stabilizer, similar to Tafamidis, but it was never had been thoroughly tested, so that was your only available product at that time. So good news, I'm now on that. I've had three different silencers because some actually work better than others, so that's where I am at the moment.
Incredible. So like you said, not lucky, but it was very fortunate that you were able to get an early diagnosis.
That's right.
Because largely of your sister. But from the time you first started noticing this breathlessness when you were climbing hills and mountains, how long did it take you to get, the final ATTR-CM ATTR diagnosis?
Well, it took 10 months, but it only took 10 months because my sister was going through the system at the same time, and she was at the point of, because it's hereditary, I've got the Irish gene, which is one of the 120 genes for this particular disease. So I was kind of fast-tracked there. I think it would have gone on like she'd gone on for about 5 years of only just getting diagnosed. We overlapped, kind of thing. So I'm sure it would have took it. And part of being on a patient organisation, we're hearing this story all the time, and it I think it's got better. I think the cardiologists and the neuropathy and even hand, so you're finding hand surgeons now kind of picking up some of the in particular hospitals that are aware of it. So it's got better, but it is a long way off yet to being easily picked up.
So Mike, can you tell us a little bit about life immediately after your diagnosis? So it took you a long time, obviously, but what were some of the biggest learnings or challenges that you faced?
I walked into the doctor's office and I couldn't spell amyloidosis. I couldn't say it. Had no idea what it was. I have a really good doctor, and he tried to explain it to me what it is. And when you walk out of there, you're saying, I walked in here thinking, I maybe have some kind of heart problem, And, there's medicines for it, whatever, will things will get better. But, he tells you have a disease that you never heard of, that there's no cure for. And at that time, like David said, there's no treatment for. It's not really, that's not really good news, But, I'm not the kind of person who says, okay, that's it. I'm going to go home and pull a blanket over my head. And just wait for the end to come. He had said that there was tafamidis existed. It was approved in Europe, but it wasn't yet approved in the United States. So, I went talking to some people I know that are from Europe and said, hey, what's the deal there? How can I get there? Can I buy an apartment there, or, and rent it out and still, go over there and get the drug? And I mean, I'm going to be perfectly honest with you. I have a friend who's a chemist. Well, we looked up the patent to see if we could make it. You know what I mean? If that, that's the situation you're in, though. I mean, it's just unfortunate. But, when you're in that kind of situation, you have to look for every way you can. So, like I said, is I started sending emails to people and find the doctor who, put me on the track for compassionate use. And, I got the drug and I was able to start improvement. But still, it's in your head. What's that going to do to you? You know what I mean? Like, I'm not ready to leave this earth in 2 years. You know what I mean? I have a pretty good life. I push myself to learn more. Like I go to like patient support meetings and, I learned stuff there, but it wasn't enough because, when doctors are talking to patients, they put everything, sugarcoat things and, they don't want to go too far in what they tell people because some people really don't want to know it. Like some patients don't want to know it. So I started going to like medical conferences, symposium. I mean, I used to pay. Sometimes I used to have to lie and say I was a doctor. They wouldn't let me in. You know what I mean? But as I went there, you're here, doctor talk to doctor. It's like being in the locker room. You know what I mean? They don't pull no punches. And I mean, I was just complaining. I was at the FDA at a conference last week, and I was complaining that all these charts and graphs today all end at 60 months, mortality. I said, man, we got treatments now. You need to change these charts because according to them, I should have been dead a few years ago. Yeah, but this is how we're moving, and we're moving fast, which is good. But and then as I went, I was I'm feeling better, and I'm saying there seems like I should be doing more. I see some of these advocacy groups and stuff, like Davis Group, but we have them here in America too. I said, it seems like I should be doing more. So as I go to these conferences, I mean, I don't know how they do it in England, but there's always a session on V122I, which is the black variant, right? I mean, it's like the I have like David, I have the T60, the Irish, luck of the Irish. Well, we have that, right? That's 1 in 100,000. The black variant is 1 in 25. You know what I mean? It's ridiculous. And then, I've been going to these conferences like 5 years. And they all end every session with more has to be done. They talk about the disparity, underserved community and stuff in our country. Say more has to be done. But I mean, like 5 years, I'm here. These are the best amyloidosis doctors in the country, sometimes in the world. These are international, right? They come from institutions that have billion-dollar annual budgets. So why after 5 years, if you can take me on their table and cut me open, transplant my heart, and send me home in a few days to go on and live life. You know what I mean? Why can't you figure out what this more is? You have the resources and you have the knowledge and you're not doing anything. So, I saw that as a form of the disparity that they're talking about in others. You know what I mean? So, that motivated me to try to do more. And, that's why, we founded the Amyloidosis Army. And we focus on the underserved community. I mean, like anybody can come to our meetings, and if you want to invite us in to put our free programs on, we'll go anywhere to anybody. It's not restricted to that, but this is where the need is. Nobody's doing it. So to me, I feel like as a patient, having gone through all of this, the obligation, I have like an obligation to give back. And I was at the International Symposium, International Amyloidosis Symposium in Mayo Clinic last year, right? And there was a doctor there from Ghana who I actually met through YouTube. He makes these really entertaining amyloidosis videos. And he was there. He had posters and stuff set up. And I talked to him. I said, how are you guys doing over there, man? He said, oh, he says, man, great. We're getting awareness out. We're doing this. I said, okay, but what happens after awareness? He says, oh, well, they die. I mean, literally, he just looked at, he says, they die. We have no treatments. So I'm saying to myself, this guy's from Ghana. They have no treatments. We're here in America, and now we have four treatments. You know what I mean? And we still have people in our country dying just because they don't know about it. And they're going to doctors that don't know about it. So, I mean, this is not right. I mean, this is not right at all. I mean, here in my hometown in Kansas City, they have a free clinic with four locations. They see 34,000 patients a year, totally free. They have 53% of the patients that come in there are black. There's not one doctor, not one nurse practitioner, not one clinician in the whole four clinics know what amyloidosis is. I had a meeting with the clinical director who's a nurse practitioner for like 20 some years. She had to Google amyloidosis before our meeting. I mean, this is ridiculous. I mean, they have thousands of patients there statistically that are going to test positive for this variant, and nobody's looking for it, you know? So, I mean, fortunately, they have an in-service day every year, and they gave us an hour time in their in-service day. I mean, I brought doctors in, and, you know, we spoke as patients as well to, you know, to let them know about, you know, let them know about the testing. I mean, these people are, you know, they don't have a lot of money, but, you know, there's a hospital system in our town that has a free clinic. So if they come there, and they also have an amyloidosis center of excellence, so they can come there and they can get free treatments. And this is what has to be done. But I mean, you know, there's other people that, you know, they're not compelled to do stuff like, you know, me or David. They're not, you know, it's just not their thing to go out there and be advocates, you know, argue with people and have people look at you like you're crazy. You know, I mean, can you imagine? I'm an old white guy. I walk in a black church in the inner city to say, hey, can I come put a program on to you? You know, well, what's it about? Well, it's about this rare disease. There's no cure for, and, you know, 1 in 25 of your congregation might have it and they're going to die. I mean, it's a tough sell to get in there. You know what I mean? It's a tough sell. But, you know, this is what you have to do. You know what I mean? And then there's other people, you know, like in David, you know, and I both, we all, you know about and go to support groups for patients. There's people and patients that have been patients for a few years that really have very little knowledge about amyloidosis. And they're so thirsty to learn. And, you know, and sometimes they just need to go to people who have, you know, who share the same experience. And they need, basically, they just need a hug. You know, they just need to talk to other people and say, hey, you know, we got it. We're hanging in there, you know, where there's life, there's hope. Don't give up. You know, like, you know, we're the first generation of patients who have treatment. Like, unfortunately, like David's sister, there was no treatments and she just passed away. Now we have treatments. And they're working on, you know, we're working on research for like depleters and stuff. But, you know, but this is what we have to do. I mean, as David's a patient, I'm a patient. You know, we come from a whole different perspective. You know, you can't pay people to do the work that we do. They're just not going to put, they're not going to put that effort in it. You know, this is not an 8 to 4 job. You know, you have to, you know, you have to be ready to give it all you got. And, you know, and it comes from me because I'm a patient. You know, I want a cure. I have a son who's gene positive. You know, he doesn't have any symptoms yet, but he's gene positive. So the more we push now, you know, the next generation of people come up that have these genes, there's a whole lot better hope. They're going to get diagnosed a lot better early.
No, absolutely. It's a long road to improving awareness, both amongst doctors and also potential patients. And organizations like both of yours are doing really great work in raising the profile of this disease. And I want to ask a little bit more on a personal level now. What kind of lifestyle changes have you made after getting your diagnosis? Maybe specifically focusing on things to improve your heart health. Maybe I could start with you, David.
Yeah, so 5 years ago, I think one of the biggest challenges, I did have to retire, which I wasn't happy about. I was pretty grumpy on that particular subject. So I guess that was a big change. I also don't walk up any mountains anymore, so that's a bit sad, because that was one of my passions. So over this last 5 years, I've kind of built within myself what my limitations are. So I work to that. And you're asking about how you work around the health side of it. I do walk regularly every day, but it just happens to be flat. Okay. So that's my kind of keep fit method. I might occasionally within the hour and a half or whatever I'm trying to walk, put a bit more speed into it. But I don't turn right to the hill, or I keep to the very steps. So, you know, I'm still able to do the majority of the activities because I am at an early stage. You know, these treatments have come at the right time. But I will say, even though I am at an early stage, because I already built up some challenge, you know, symptoms in the heart and the peripheral nervous systems, these treatments don't get rid of that. you have to live. You know, that's why it's so important we get people early and not wait till, you know, 2-3 years down the line, because once that part of your body has been damaged, you live with that. There's nothing at the moment, although, as you said, they're looking at some other types of treatments that will actually take the amyloid away from the body, and that's very exciting. But we've got to think of it at the moment and get everybody as much as possible to start the treatment early if they've got the symptoms and it's been confirmed that they've got it. So still doing lots of walking. That's my kind of go-to target. You know, as Mike says, it is, you know, you both of us, I think I was in Rochester actually, Mike, so but must have passed you a few times in the Mayo Clinic doing the tours, etc. So doing this is kind of my next kind of vocation. And you know, one of the things Mike said was that it's kind of a bit personal, because you know, you're giving it to, you know, I've got three children, I've got two grandchildren, I've probably got, with my other siblings, 17, 18 people, and half of them are going to get this disease. You know, there's no kind of saying that's not the case, because that's what the percentage is. So it is a very personal journey. And, you know, my desire, like Mike, is to, you know, get people treated. I'm not just talking about my family or me. Yes, I want my kids to be in a position that it's a historical disease, that you have one drug and you're sorted for life. We've got a bit way to go with that yet, but it might not be that far. That might not be that far off. So, you know, that's the hope for the future.
What about you, Mike? Did you notice, or did you have to make any lifestyle changes in addition to the treatments that you were taking, to your diet or maybe restrictions on physical activity, exercise, and so on?
I mean, obviously there were some restrictions, but I mean, literally before I had any treatments, I mean, I used to go to work and sit in my car and just look at the front door for like 15 minutes before I got enough energy to get out and go inside. You know, and now, I mean, I'm on both treatments. You know, I mean, I'm on a silencer and I'm on a stabilizer, but I still have limitations. Like, I mean, I can't walk up hills. I can't, you know, flat land sometimes give me a problem when I go too far, you know, but you know, I don't, if I lift, I get exerted. You know, I can go up a flight of stairs, you know, if I take it easy. If I start going to two flights of stairs, it starts getting a little, you know, takes my breath away. And, you know, you just, you know, it's like anything else. Like if you start wearing glasses or you get braces or whatever, you know, your body slowly acclimates to it. And, you know, you just automatically adjust. You know what your limitations are. And, you know, you try not to avoid it. You know, like at work, you know, if there's like heavy boxes and stuff I got to move or put in my car, you know, I'll get somebody else to do it for me. You know, if I get lazy, I'll tell them, hey, I got amyloidosis, I can't do this, you know. But, you know, there's certain limitations. You know, I mean, like there's really no dietary approach to amyloidosis. I mean, exercise is good, you know, because, you know, you have to keep your whole body. It's just not amyloidosis. You're still a person, you know. But David, there's nothing that says where, you know, you can eat certain diet and that's going to help your amyloidosis. You know, eat healthy. I mean, that's generally good for everything, you know. But, they tell you things that you should do is, you know, like people should avoid drinking too much. You know, I mean, I don't personally drink, but, you know, because it has an adverse effect. And you never know, like with these medications, they're working on us. But look, these are brand new medications. There's no 20-year, 30-year look back to see what they're. So we don't really know everything they're doing to us. You know, like they're making our amyloidosis better, but we don't know if they're doing anything else in our body. You know, and you know, it takes years for this stuff to come out. But, you know, if you have a rare disease with no cure, you're willing to take a lot more risk for a lot less benefit. You know what I mean? I mean, it's the only game in town. So, you know, we just have to, you know, our bodies, I think, just, I don't know, as far as David's, I mean, I think we just naturally learn to adjust to what we can now do and what we can't do. And, you know, we just have to make the best of it. I mean, you know, 6 years ago or 7 years ago, when I got diagnosed, there was no treatment. You know, they could have took my arm to get a treatment, you know? Now we're in a position where we're arguing about which of the four is best, or, you know, how much they cost. You know what I mean? What a great position to be in, you know what I mean, as patients. So we just have to make the adjustments and go on the best we can, and do the best we can for everybody.
And both of you have touched upon this quite a bit about this necessity of a support system or having like a network around you for information, for awareness, for support in general. So I kind of wanted to ask what for you personally was the most important kind of support, whether it was mental health support, nutritional support, physical activity counseling, etc. And what kind of support you think is the most important for patients in general?
Yeah, I think we all remember our first time going to these specialist hospitals and not being aware, like Mike says, even saying the word amyloidosis, it wasn't something that you just flew off your mind. So you're going in there with virtually no knowledge. We try and avoid, certainly I didn't. I looked on every Google and other types of review sites, and it was pretty gloomy. And that's the worst thing you can suggest to anybody to go and do. We do it with everything else in life, but let's not do it with amyloidosis or other rare diseases, I guess, because the stuff on there is so out of date. And when you go into the hospital, they're very focused on on getting you diagnosed. They're very focused on getting you on the treatment, and then actually, what other support is there? They're very good at those particular two aspects, and then you're looking around and starting to educate yourself and build up knowledge. One of the biggest things I always say to patients is become the expert of this disease, because you're going to constantly go, even when you go to the doctors for another particular ailment, and they'll look at the amyloidosis and think it relates to that, and you have to tell the doctor, no, that particular thing isn't amyloidosis, it's something else that you need to look at. You need to become the expert of this disease, and it's so important that you build that knowledge up. And then if you can, if there is groups that you can join, within our country, we have support groups geographically, and we encourage people to go and get build up relationships in terms of getting to understand the disease. It's so important, and not everybody can do that, because some people are introvert, or they might be shy or anything like that. But it's something I try and encourage people to do. We have Amyloidosis UK, who supports the whole of the United Kingdom, and then I'm also part of this other group, Amyloidosis Alliance, and we've got 28 countries that we support. And that's so, we've got some really established charities globally who are very big and got everything, and you've got some small countries that are just a couple of patients starting out, because we all started off that way, and we try and build up their skills and knowledge and confidence to go to the next level in every single country. And as Mike says, the saddest thing when we're together, we were at the conference in Italy a few weeks ago. We talk about, you've got some people from America and Canada and the United Kingdom, France and Italy, and they have everything. And then you talk to people from Colombia and Brazil and Uruguay, and they have very little. They're like what we were 10 years ago, and that because it's a family. The disease has created us as a family of people that want to work together to get everybody getting the same drugs at the same time. We also support amyloidosis, support AL amyloidosis, which is a different kind of treatment. But when you talk to them, they've got the same problems of people not being aware of the disease. We've got people with wild type who are now the majority of our patients, and the majority of the country, if they live long enough, will get wild type amyloidosis. And as Mike says about the Black African Caribbean community, they're definitely underserved in Europe as well. But we also, and now just picked up, that wild type patients that are female are also significantly, only 1 in 10 are getting diagnosed at the moment. And it's a fact, it's not that there's only 10% of the popular the female sex having this disease. It's because the way they're evaluated and the way that, you know, that it's not getting picked up. So that's another disparity that we are really challenging at the moment. And that wild type obviously affects the heart as the majority for that particular patient.
Mike, you mentioned some of the work that your organization does and about how sometimes patient just needs a hug, basically, and someone to talk to. And for you personally, what kind of support, not drug or pharmaceutical related, did you think was most essential?
Well, you know, we're all different personalities. I mean, I'm kind of like a stubborn guy that, you know, I think, you know, there's got to be a way to get out of everything. You know what I mean? So my support comes from, you know, just being able, it's not really self-support, because what I do, I can't do by myself. You know what I mean? I've been inspired by other people. I'm encouraged by other people. So, you know, my support is to react, to try to do something. First, you know, of course, I try to help myself. You know, then I have to find my son's gene positive, so I have to find to do more. And then, you know, I think that just the way I am as a person, I naturally go to try to do something so that, you know, let's help everybody. Like David said, we're a family now. We're in this together. You know, we're bound by, you know, it's like being on a team or like being in war. You know, we get bound together by amyloidosis. So, I mean, I don't care who you are, where you are, what color you are, you know, amyloidosis is the enemy. That's what we're going after, you know. And, you know, as far as patients, I think the patient's biggest support, what they need is information. You know, they need information, because I just came from, you know, this huge biannual patient support group meeting where they had all these doctors speaking to all these patients, you know what I mean? And, you know, these patients, some of them been patients for a long time. They're still asking these basic questions about amyloidosis. They didn't Google like me and David did and go out and look. They, you know, they just want these basics. You know, they don't even know about the dual treatments and, you know, and they're on treatments. And, you know, and there's so much difference, and there's so many questions that they have that, you know, like to me and David, we're doing this. We, you know, we go into it, you know, we're saying, you know, you should have knew that, like, you know, day one. But, you know, people don't. And this information, you know, it calms them inside, you know, gives them some hope and stuff like that. And, you know, my wife went with me this weekend, you know, she just went with me. Thanks for keep me out of trouble. And, you know, on the way home, we're driving, and we have an 8-hour drive back home. And she was telling me, you know, she said they had all kinds of doctors there, neurologists, cardiologists, gastronomists, geneticists, you know, they had all these doctors there, which, well, but she said, you know, they really should have like a psychologist or a psychiatrist there to explain the mental things that a patient could go through that has, you know, they're told they have a terminal disease they have to live with. And for the caregivers, you know, it's a mental toll on the caregivers as well. You know, like, I mean, I'm sure David had a lot of struggles with his sister, watching her deteriorate. There's nothing you can do, you know. And then, and, you know, especially in his case, is this me down the road, you know? Like, she's going through this now. 5 years from now, is this going to be me? You know, is my siblings going to be looking at me and say, man, David, what can we do for you? So, I mean, I thought that was a really good observation, you know, that, you know, you need somebody there to address the mental aspect for people as well. You know, and not just the patients, the caregivers. The caregivers are, you know, they're such a huge part of that, you know, and they go through, you know, as a patient, you know, I look at my wife, she's, well, you know, you don't got amyloidosis, you don't know what's doing, you know what I mean? And, but then, you know, you have to take a minute and think, you know, this is her life too. You know, I mean, we share a life, you know, I have a son, you know, so I share a life with him. So it's just, there's a lot more to this than just support. You know, like, you can't just pick one thing. Like, everybody's different, you know, but I think the common denominator for everybody is information. I think information can give people mental support, you know, and it shows that there's hope. Like, now they spend a lot of time talking about the treatments that we have now, but they also talk about the ones that are in trials. I mean, you know, they have trials now, you know, the pleaders, they have CRISPR, you know, maybe they're going to go in there and genetically take the, you know, change your DNA so you don't have, you know, the bad gene, the proteins won't misfold anymore. So these are encouraging things that patients want to hear. And even if, like I look at it, even if it's not for us, I mean, we might have to take one for the team. We're the first generation, we're getting a little old anyway, But, for the next generation, like our kids, and like David, he has a big family. He has younger people in his family. There's hope. You know what I mean? But, the only way we can get this hope and keep this momentum going is we have to bang the drum. We have to tell anybody who will listen, this is what we do. This is exists. It can happen to anybody. We have to keep pushing. The more people we push, the patients push the doctors push pharma for more research and stuff like that. And that's the future. And we've gone, like David said, man, the last few years we've gone, basically light years. But we have to keep that momentum going. We just have to keep it going. And the only way we're gonna keep it going is like you with this podcast, like David with all his great groups, like over here with our group and the other groups we work with over here. I mean, that's the support we have to give patients. When they need that something, they know they can call one of us and say, hey, you know what I mean? I don't understand. My test said this, my test said that, or I'm not feeling good today. So, you have to adjust to it. You have to either be, compassionate and say, okay, all right. Or you have to say, hey, dude, man, you maybe want to go to another doctor. Maybe you want to go to a center of excellence instead of messing around with this little doctor in this small town. I mean, it's just, you just never know. You just never know. But nothing for me is better than when a person that came to our program at some church didn't know anything about amyloidosis when they walked in that door, but took our advice, took our test, came back positive, went to the doctor, got diagnosed way early, and say, hey, thank you, man. I went to the doctor, I went to the center of excellence you sent us to. I got diagnosed. You know what I mean? I have, my symptoms are like hardly anything, but now I'm on a treatment, and so things should be better. I mean, for us, like David, I'm sure for advocates like us, that's what keeps us going. Because we don't get paid. I don't know about England. Over here, we don't get paid. Yeah, we don't get paid. So, our pay is when somebody comes up to you and says, thanks, thanks for doing it. I can't do it. It's not me. I can't go stand on a table at a black church and tell people about this disease. I can't go to a symposium and stand up and say, I'm a patient. You need to pay attention to us, but you're doing it for all of us. And that's the reward for doing this. And hopefully it'll lead to some, maybe we, maybe me and David aren't too late for a cure. Who knows at the Cleveland?
Absolutely. Yeah, no.
Yeah. Where there's life, there's hope. That's what I'm saying, man. If you're breathing, you're fighting,
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I'm really glad you mentioned information as a resource that's so important, because David has also been involved with the World Heart Federation in developing a toolkit that's designed for patients and caregivers who have ATTR-CM. So it helps you track symptoms and get information on what the disease is, how it progresses, who to approach, what kind of specialties you need to consider. So I'm just wondering, because you've spoken a lot about working with these underserved communities through your work with the churches and so on. So these kind of resources are usually online, or there's a barrier between the people who develop them and the people who need them. How would you say these barriers can be broken so that the people who need this information get access to it? Maybe I can start with you again, Mike.
Well, that's the biggest problem. We're talking about the underserved community. I mean, that's a problem for all the communities. Okay, I particularly work in that because nobody here is doing this. We're literally the only organization in the United States that's doing this. And every time I go to meetings where they have, advocacy leadership meetings and stuff, we're the only awareness group there. Everybody else is patient support. There's nobody else in awareness. You know what I mean? To get the information to the people is extremely hard. And like they start putting commercials now on TV about amyloidosis, But the commercials they put on TV and ours are like, older white guys, middle class, that's one in 100,000. Why would you try to get to the one in 100,000 when you have a humongous population where it's one in 25? And until people change that mindset and start, addressing the information. Like I meet with pharma companies all the time. And I say, hey, you have to change your pamphlets. You know, you give me pamphlets that are just disease oriented, and I take to my meetings and I pass them out to people, right? You have to change them. I mean, you know, I'm not in the same circle that everybody else is. We have to make these things more understandable. You know, and like our meeting, we don't have doctors. You know, we have a doctor come and speak and stuff. No, nobody stands up there with a white coat, you know, and reads with these, you know. It's all, you know, personal, conversational. We serve people a meal. We make them feel comfortable where they can ask questions and they can talk. And, you know, that's, you know, it's, you just have to deal with who you're dealing with, you know. And I mean, if you're at Harvard talking to the graduating medical class, okay, that's a whole different story. If you're on the streets, and that's where you have to start, especially in an underserved community, you have to start in the streets. You can't start at the top. You have to start at the bottom where the people are. And you'd be surprised once you get past that prejudice and the constrictions that they have about trusting the medical community that's been, you know, basically not given the best care, you know, and they still come up and ask questions about Tuskegee, you know, this thing happened like 80 years ago or 90 years ago, this experiment that, you know, but, you know, this is what you have to, you know, you have to get by that barrier, and then you also have to get by the establishment's barrier. And, but, you know, these are where the people, these are the most, I mean, I don't know if you're aware of it, but Brigham's Women did a study last year and said that if the black population in the United States over 50 was correctly diagnosed, it would add 1 million life years to that population. I mean, you know, that's dramatic, you know. So I mean, that's dramatic, but, you know, we still have, you know, the inbred prejudices and stuff like that, that, you know, it's just human nature. But, you know, this is amyloidosis. We got to get by that, man. We can't care about that. You know, and when I first started doing this, people were telling me, no, you'll never do it. They're laughing, you know. And, you know, I mean, I did it on my own for a year. Nobody helped me. You know, then all of a sudden, you know, I start looking around in my little meetings. I see a little pharma rep sitting over here. I see somebody else sitting over here, you know. And then, you know, like a year later, they say, hey, I think this guy might have something, you know what I mean? So, you know, let's try to get involved and put some support in, and which has recently happened. And it's, you know, it's made a big difference. It's made it be able, we can travel all over the country now, with, you know, instead of just, you know, staying in one spot. But, you know, we don't promote anything. We don't encourage anything. I always tell people, you know, the choice of your medication, your treatment is you and your doctor. You know what I mean? You and your doctor alone. You know what I mean? There's four treatments out there. I'm on two. If I could find somebody to pay for them, I'd take all four. You know what I mean? That, I mean, that, literally, that's the way I feel. And, you know, and if you go on our website, we're the only nonprofit website on the internet that doesn't have a donate button. You know what I mean? We don't want patients to give us money. We don't want people to give us money. You know, there's people who make money off of amyloidosis. You know what I mean? So they should be the ones that support our advocacy. I mean, and if they won't do it, you know, then I'll just do it on my own.
Yeah, I'm going to answer this in a slightly different angle because you talked about the toolkit. You know, the landscape has changed so significantly in the last 4 years. World Heart Federation came to us 4 years ago for the policy document, which is just about what is amyloidosis, and we did work with you on that. So that was kind of, oh, these treatments are coming now. Even World Heart Federation are interested in it to be talking about it. So that was the landscape change. So I don't know about you, Mike. When I went to the doctor, you know, I can still see him now. So there's no treatments, and but there's hope, and that was really good. Have this to keep you going. But that same doctor 2 years later says, "Look, we've now got something," and his total enthusiasm completely. It was enthusiastic before, but now you got treatments. It became such a better scenario with, you know, because he went into the health side to cure people or treat people, and now he's got something to do that. So that was a terrific change, and the landscape has changed significantly. We've just done the toolkit, which is really good. It's an up to date. Every country's got something on the go, every farmer, every advocate group. So this is a nice up to date document. In a year's time, it might well be out of date because it's it's changing that fast. It was good also that you had it in four languages with French, Spanish, Portuguese, and English. So that's really good. So that was another positive. But one of the things we've done this year with the Amyloid Alliance, we've gone to some more conferences, but not our own ones, but going to the Peripheral Neuropathy Society conference. Again, you know, these talks, 50-70% of it just goes over your head. But we went there to aim at the doctors to raise the profile. And we also did it with the International Hand Conference as well, because carpal tunnel is, you know, is certainly appearing to be the first symptom that is showing up to be able to evaluate that you've got this disease. So we aim for them as well. But I think the biggest one this year was the European Cardiac Conference. I think that was in, was it Madrid, was it? And, you know, there were 70,000 cardiologists there. They had actually 71 presentations about amyloidosis. And I said to one of the cardiologists who I knew, and he said, if you went back 5 years ago, they'd have about five in this conference, because this conference is every year. And that just shows you the change that is going on. And the awareness is still significantly not where we want it to be, but it is getting better. And the targeting of those key consultants, cardiologists, peripheral neuropathy, is so, so important. Because I always hear about from my colleagues in this journey, they say, oh, we want the GPs, general practitioners, and your local doc. You know, it's just feasibly, you know, impossible. There's 4,000 plus rare diseases. So we've got to kind of target what's going to give us the biggest result. So we're trying to kind of work on that. And, you know, your toolkit was well received at the conference. And
okay, as a last question to both of you, and just some final reflections, what would you say or advise to any ATTR-CM patients who might be listening into our podcast, especially to the newly diagnosed patients who might be navigating life with this diagnosis? We can start with you, David.
Well, I'm going to repeat myself on this one. I think if we got to this point and I hadn't really mentioned it. So my advice still remains for a newly diagnosed patient is to learn about the disease, become an expert. As the challenge if you have the lack of knowledge, then you know, you're not going to get the treatments that you need. I always also say, you know, I got it quick in terms of, if you're going to go and see these doctors, always take someone in with you. If it's your partner, your friend, a family member, because, you know, you only pick up 30% of what's being said. And taking that other person in, you know, doubles what you're hearing and what you're saying. So that's just a little practical element. And it's always going to be a rare disease, although wild type might not be so rare. So gaining that knowledge is really, really important. And ignore all the information on Google. Don't follow it. Get the up-to-date information that is out there, because that's so much better. So get involved. And take this disease head on first.
Thank you. And what about you, Mike?
Yeah, well, I agree with pretty much everything David just said. But I mean, if you're a patient and you're newly diagnosed, I mean, stay away from Google is a good idea, but they're going to do it. You just can't help yourself, you know. But I'm just saying, when you go to your doctor's office, ask very specific questions. Don't be shy, or don't be. You know, if you have a question, ask him. You know what I mean? Don't think you got to get rushed out of there. If you have a question, ask and follow up until you understand what he's saying. And when you do go on Google, instead of just reading all the doom and gloom and stuff on there, you'll see advocacy groups, you know, like David's, or like in America, we got amyloidosis support groups, right? Don't just look at their website. Call the phone number on there. Talk to somebody, you know, talk, because they'll take the time. And then, you know, they've been there and done that. So they know, they'll talk you through it. They'll give you, say, okay, well, if you really need these answers, you know, go to this website, or let's call this person here. So don't be scared to call the numbers on there or send them an email, say, hey, I want to talk to somebody about this because I really don't understand it, and that's where you have to go. And whatever you do when you go, like when we have our programs, we have a pamphlet, we made a booklet that has the symptoms. We have 2 pages of questions you should ask your doctor you go on the first visit. And then we have 2 pages of diagnostic algorithms for the doctor in case he don't know what amyloidosis is, But don't be shy. And you're a patient. You're paying this doctor for his time. So you get your questions answered. Don't walk out of there saying, oh, amyloidosis, this and that. I mean, be just as confused as you walked in. There's the doctor. He's going to have some good answers. There's some answers he's not going to give you if you don't ask. He's not going to tell you. He's not going to tell you things, just randomly. He'll tell you the essentials. But if you have specific questions, because they may be bad news, and they try not to tell you bad news, ask them. Just bluntly ask them whatever the question is, and tell them, well, answer me. Be straight up with me. Don't worry about sugarcoating it or making it more palatable for me. Tell me, I want to know what the real situation is, and what my options are, and what do you think about this treatment, or what do you think about this trial? Is there a trial I can get into that'll help? I mean, that's where. That's what you have to do when you're new, because you don't know what you don't know. So the only way you're going to know is you have to go to people you can ask. Reading stuff on the internet is one thing, but having somebody in front of you that you can ask the follow-up questions, that's really important.
Yeah, and one other thing I was going to say is that, when we first started with this disease, it was pretty gloomy. But the treatments that are developed now and what are coming down the road are so much more better. And the outlook, certainly when I talk to my kids, is not the same as what it was 3, 4 years ago. And it's looking more and more positive. But there's lots of people out there that aren't diagnosed, and that's what we've got to focus on.
Yeah, we have to find them. We have to get them, we have to get them diagnosed. 'Cause like right now, the earlier the better. I mean, I don't know if you guys in England or in Europe have the access to the ACT Early trial that BridgeBio's just done, where they're actually gonna they're have a trial with people who are gene positive can actually get on the drug.
Yeah, we're trialing that one.
And they're doing a trial this year.
That's so
Yeah.
it's looking very yeah. The people are we are, in fact, one of my colleagues are on it.
I mean, that's a great step forward. It's a great step forward, and if it works, that's going to help patients who, like now, if you're asymptomatic but you have the gene, nobody wants to pay for the drugs. It's money. They don't want to pay for the drugs. But if you do this trial and you show that this works, then future people are going to be able to get on these drugs even before they have symptoms, just because they're gene positive. Which, in the long run, it saves the healthcare system tons of money. The more drugs we get out there, the market's going to come down. And I don't know about Europe. You guys, I got a different system, but here, I have never met anybody that pays out of pocket for these drugs. You know what I mean? Nobody can afford. You can't. You know what I mean? My drugs cost $800,000 a year. I'm going to be dead in 6 months at that rate. You know what I mean? I ain't got the money. But there's ways to get it, insurance programs and stuff like that. So we can't let that, slow anybody down. We have to get people diagnosed. We have to get them on treatments. And that's the whole goal.
And on that note, David and Mike, both of you have provided us with such interesting and valuable insights into your stories of living with ATTR-CM, the importance of support networks and organizations, and the need to improve timely diagnosis and treatment. Thank you both again so much for coming onto our podcast, sharing your experiences, and helping us raise awareness on ATTR-CM.
Hey, thank you very much,
Great.
Jill.
Thank you, Shira, as always.
We also thank our listeners who continue to tune in their numbers. Don't forget to share and, of course, tune in to more episodes on heart and health by going on to World Heart Podcasts on all major platforms.